That's folk singer Richie Havens with Darkness, Darkness, first recorded by the Youngbloods in 1969. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we are talking about a darkness that fell upon Paris on Friday, killing more than 130 people in six different locations as terrorists struck. And Paris and much of Europe and outside of Europe, we are seeing evidence that people are now beginning to reassess the countries, their various countries' stance on ISIS, which has claimed responsibility for the attacks, but also their own individual policies toward the so-called Middle East, but also the ongoing tensions that have been at the root of this terrorist type of violence. I want to ask you to go along with us today. We are being joined by Gilbert Messier, who is a journalist and writer, analyst, filmmaker, and editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post. That's newsjunkiepost.com. You can find his latest writings. And he is the author of a just-released book, The Orwellian Empire. Of course, Gilbert Messier is not a stranger to us here on Lead Stories. We've been talking about these issues, and particularly from the point of view as a Frenchman and journalist, he has a particular vantage point to offer. Thanks, Gilbert, for being with us.
My pleasure, Eutrice. Even so, it's on, as usual, unfortunately, on your show, a dark occasion to talk about Paris, which is supposed to be the city of light. So it, there's a lot of... it's a very dark moment for, needless to say, everybody in France, but also everybody in the world and everybody in Europe.
No question about that. But here, Gilbert, you had offered us an insight into this question about 10 months ago on the occasion of the attacks on the Charlie Hebdo magazine. And there were certain connections that you made. If you can revisit those connections for us today, in the aftermath of the attacks on Friday, do you see any continuing suggestion here that the problems that you were talking about before continue and are even worse?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is it's much bigger. In a sense, the impact is a lot higher than the attack on Charlie Hebdo, which was, you know, an attack on a specific publication for specific reason, which was the republication of cartoon deemed offensive by Muslim, cartoon of Prophet Muhammad, and against a cashier market in one of the Paris suburbs. So that was very, very specific. The attack on Friday was a lot wider and sort of random. It kind of attacked the sort of easy and sort of cozy French way of life. You know, I'm sure all of your listeners have heard about the various spots, but it's all kind of very symbolic in a sense, because they, three of the attackers detonated themselves outside a stadium during a football soccer game between France national team and Germany. It was a friendly game, but it's a huge deal in Europe, of course. There were like 80,000 people in the Stade de France, which is in the northern suburb of Paris. and President Hollande was assisting the game, and it was sort of, in a way, if you wish, a made-for-TV attack, because the noise of the explosion outside the stadium, I repeat, was heard on TV, and within the stadium, and François Hollande was immediately whisked out by the French Secret Service in a move that I personally find a little bit strange. He could have stayed within the stadium and sort of assume his role of leadership. However, he didn't. He was whisked away. And at the same time, there were several other attacks. The major one was against a concert hall that's called the Bataclan, that's been around for more than 30 years, and that is very, very well known. And this one was done with a shotgun, just basically shooting randomly into the crowd and killing right there at the Bataclan, more than 75 people. Now, you mentioned that 132 people got killed. The death tally is likely to be a lot higher, because right now there's more than close to 400 people, and about half of that are critically injured. So it could go very easily into the 250, 300 dead. And the reaction is very, very different. The reaction was almost immediate. Within 3 hours, Hollande went from the Saint-Denis Stadium to the Bataclan very, very quickly. And they quickly organized a cabinet meeting at midnight between Friday and Saturday and decreed a state of emergency. The state of the emergency, and that happened today, was a first installed in France in 1955, to be precise, during at the heat of the war with Algeria, and they haven't used that measure at all, and they can have it by decree from the president, according to the Constitution of the Fifth Republic, for 12 days. However, in front of a joint session of French Congress, which is the Senate and Congress, Assemblée nationale and Sénat, Hollande is pushing, and he will get the vote. He will probably get almost an unanimous vote for an extension of that state of emergency of 3 months. And the state of emergency is very, very, very difficult, at least for me, not for most French people, to swallow. It entails no possibility of any kind of demonstration in the Île-de-France, which is the wide Paris area, if you wish. So no possibility of public gathering. Anybody, they can do any perquisition in private home or any businesses or any building as they wish. And they can also arrest people deemed to be dangerous. Of course, all this is very elastic. If you wish, what France got into Friday night was sort of a patriot act by decree, but sort of on steroid. And it's extremely alarming, of course, for the things that I care about, which is civil liberties and basic individual freedom. Now, they are, it seems that every single element now is pointing towards Belgium at the center, at least in terms of the organization of the attacks in Paris, of that attack, and it's located in a town in a suburb of Brussels that is called Molenbeek. And the lead, the brain of the operation, if you wish, if you can call that a brain, and personally I would hesitate to do so, Belgium has been actually kind of a center previously to ISIS, to Al-Qaeda network, even before 9/11/2001. And let me give some specific information here, which I'm sure your listener have no clue about. Two jihadists pretended to be journalists and went to interview Shah Massoud in Afghanistan 2 days before 9/11 and killed them. So it's the problem is. And everybody, they call it in France, they call it l'Union Sacrée, but what is it? The statement now is France is at war, but the war is, unfortunately, it's a war from within. And it is it's more than a slippery slope. We're getting into an Orwellian territory. We're getting into a territory where people will accept, and they are accepting in all my conversations, people are actually finding, and I'm quoting, that the state of emergency is reassuring. So ordinary French citizen, and of course there is no critic from anybody on the political spectrum, from the far right to the left, even somebody like Mélenchon, which is the left, has not made any sort of public critic of the repressive measure that are going to be taking effect into law. Starting very likely Wednesday. Nobody is critiquing anything. Everybody just want to be safe. You know,
let me ask you this, because this is really important to establish some links here. You mentioned Belgium as being, and it's now being discussed as the hub of terrorist action. And, of course, the search is on in Belgium now. They're looking for other suspects who might be related to the attacks in Paris. But before, in our conversations, as we discussed the rise of Islamophobia in Paris in particular, but in Europe generally, is this in some way, in your view, are people beginning to move that aside as being unimportant, or is this an outgrowth of this general anti-Islamic sentiment that has been growing rapidly and overtly throughout Europe?
Well, you see, Utrecht, this is a vicious cycle. It kind of feeds on itself, but what people should keep in mind in general, only people who do not have anything to live for, and that is really the vast majority of the disenfranchised young French from Arab origin or Belgium from Arab origin for that matter, to live. And that, it's the only way where people can do the unthinkable of becoming a suicide bomber. I mean, the root of all this, okay, is really a failure from not only France, but also, Great Britain, Germany, Belgium, all the EU, to integrate those young EU citizens, because most of them were born in Europe, of Arab origin in the social fabric. I mean, the way I see it, and I wrote something about it yesterday in News Junkie Post, is really we need to talk about the socioeconomic problem here. And the socioeconomic problem is absolutely dreadful. The rate of unemployment, just to give an idea to your listener, among young French of Arab origin or African origin, younger than 25, is about 45%. They live in awful condition in like projects. Literally projects that are called in French HLM, and they always in very bad area in the suburb, and those people have very little to hope for from the French society, and they are in many way, and that has been going on for decades, excluded for this lovely French way of life, which is fine if you have money, if you have a job, if you can actually enjoy it. It's not if you have no source of income. So what do? Well, they go, potentially they go to mosques, and mosques that are financed by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the like, and they potentially get recruited by the imams into doing things that are just, borderline insane. You know, and of course, the more they do it, the more it's creating, and it's going to be a lot worse now. There were already three or four mosques that were set on fire. They tried to set them on fire in France since Friday. It's going to be the equation, Muslim equal terrorist, is going to be at play politically more and more, and used not only by the far right, Marine Le Pen and Nicolas Sarkozy, which is making a big comeback, but also by the pseudo-left, which is François Hollande. I mean, to me, what happened in France, and I'm not saying, I am absolutely, conspiracy theory is really not something that I tolerate whatsoever. But it's kind of, in a way, what they did by that, sort of ASTIP, meeting down on the with all this angst and emotion. It's sort of a coup. It's sort of like in a way between the Patriot Act and Crystal Light in Germany, circa 1933 when Adolf Hitler took over. I mean, this is very serious. They sort of illusion that repression and policing and having a military all over the damn place, and bombing Syria, which they did, by the way, last night. Last night, there were like a French attack on Syria, in Raqqa, to be specific. And it is exactly the same reaction than George W. Bush after 9/11, where the reaction was vengeance. This is what it's sort of the... blood is calling for blood, and it is not, it's really not the way to deal with problems, obviously. Because we've tried that route before. What I'm saying is we, the West in general, and it obviously doesn't work. It, as a matter of fact, it's extremely counterproductive, and it makes problems worse.
So why is France, at least this, France has been singled out for attack. Why France, and it's not the only country, obviously, that has been singled out as having something to do with the conflagration in the so-called Middle East, but what is it about France? What is France's role in that area that so aggravates the populace, if you will?
Well, I'll tell you, the role is very simple. The role comes from French history of colonialism, and they don't they people are not, even the French intelligentsia, what's left of it, are not even framing it in those terms, which is basically, and they're still doing it. François Hollande, and we talked about it on your show, did that in Mali, he did that in République de Centrafrique. There's French troops there. They are part of, they work with AFRICOM. Of course, they work with the U.S. coalition to bomb Iraq and Syria, but what is the goal? What is the what is the strategy? There's not really a defined strategy, and I'll give you an example. Okay, the problem seems to be Islamist fundamentalists. Okay, which are, you know, the prime recruit for ISIS. Why not then support, instead of trying to dismantle that, support somebody like Bashar al-Assad, which is a secular ruler. He's a dictator, but he's a secular ruler. He's not an Islamist. You know, so it's sort of, it's kind of schizophrenic, if you wish, because the culprit, the people that finance all those operations at the start, now they're kind of backtracking again. It's Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the Emirates. You know, they behind all those things. At the origin, they were. Now they're saying, "Oh well, we need to fight terrorism. You know, it needs to be united and so on." But largely, it's a problem, at least in the Middle East, but worldwide, that was created, well, since like 14 years. I mean, this is not something that just happened. It's been building up. And the problem is people think that action do not have consequences, but they do. And often the reaction to something so terrible as what happened in France is more important than the action itself. It's the way you sort of react to things. You know, there's a lot of psychological element to it. And right now, you know, people in France are in the state of shock. But they need to understand the perspective of the people that they have contributed to ruin. They have contributed to ruin the life of Syrians, of Iraqis, and so on for, for more than a decade now. So it's sort of, the way people feel about it, the way people in the Middle East feel about it is, okay, our life is miserable. Okay, you are part of the reason why our country is completely destroyed. We're going to make you feel the pain. It's kind of a, you know, it's a psychological effect.
Your book, The Orwellian Empire, kind of brings this point up where you talk about conditions lending themselves to the imposition of unprecedented authority and authoritarianism in governments across the board. Did you feel this coming on, or was this something prescient that you started to write about? Or what was the turning point for you to write about the Orwellian Empire? And do you see, in a sense, with this awful tragedy on Friday, does it make the point that you were trying to make in the book?
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, I would say it does. And I've been writing about this and talking about this for a very, very long time, but specifically in the case of Syria, from the very beginning. I mean, the policy of making up pseudo-revolution, or actually more accurately, hijacking the Arab Spring that was real in Tunisia into some kind of monstrosity, allowing to get rid of Gaddafi and to try to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. No, that is the problem. And that is so It was stupid and borderline criminal in terms of the stupidity of it. It's sort of like, again, can you not see and admit the mistake that you've done and try to correct it? Now, Hollande is trying to do a little bit of that. But it's kind of after the fact. He called today for a emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, and he wants to talk to have a conversation with both Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama. The thing is, ISIS is a problem. It has become a problem. It's from the making of, well, everybody is sort of complicit in a way. All the Western power and the authoritarian regime of the Middle East are all complicit in it. But they now trying to understand that it got completely out of hand, they're not controlling it, and they're trying to kill it. They can only kill it if there's a coordination between what the Russians are doing for their part with Bashar al-Assad army and what the American and the French and the ally are doing on the eastern part of Syria, in specifically Raqqa and in Iraq, and coordinate also with, of course, the Iranian and Hezbollah. I mean, it is not, they have to admit, and they should do it publicly, they will not, that they were wrong, and they need to reassess the policy. They need to reassess the policy in terms of the imperialist agenda that with the U.S. in the lead that all the Western countries had since the invasion of Afghanistan. You know, the invasion of Afghanistan was largely completely unjustified. You know, the man that blew themselves up to take down the World Trade Center were Saudi Arabia nationals. They were not Afghans. They were not Taliban. You see, that's the problem. The problem is there's a lack of coherence in foreign policy, and there's been a lack of coherence in foreign policy for decades.
Well, I'm sure you're monitoring things, and we will come back to you, Gilbert, when we have some more to go on and to help us understand these things that are occurring. And I want to thank you so much for helping us understand that today.
Right.
And we will continue this conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Yotris. I would like to add a point just to make your listener understand how bad the situation is in terms of the fear and paranoia Orwellian element that is spreading in France. There's a proposition from a French congressman, his name is Laurent Vauquier, to put in detention camp every suspect that is already been tracked under what they call the S file. And that's about 5-7 people. So what does that mean? I mean, to me, it's kind of like, hello, have we forgotten the Adolf Hitler concentration camp? I mean, what are we going to do? We're going to, like, have cops everywhere, security camera everywhere. I mean, it is kind of a nightmarish sort of future if people do not react, if people worldwide do not react and resist this, you know, monstrosity.
Thanks again. Thanks, Gilbert.
You are very welcome, Utris, anytime.
Thank you. We'll take this break and come back and discuss how this event, this tragedy, this great tragedy, has impacted the minds of politicians back home.
None amongst them is the day that brings my heaven. Darkness, be my blanket, cover me,
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. The second Q&A session, I refuse to call it a debate, with Democratic presidential hopefuls that occurred on Saturday, featuring former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, astutely avoided making any connection between U.S. foreign policy and the rise of ISIS and the consequent rise in terror attacks. Here's a synopsis of where they went on this question.
Now, please welcome to Drake University former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland. At a time of crisis, the country and the world look to the president for leadership and for answers. So, Secretary Clinton, I'd like to start with you. Hours before the attacks, President Obama said, "I don't think ISIS is gaining strength." 72% of Americans think the fight against ISIS is going badly. Won't the legacy of this administration, which you were a part of, won't that legacy be that it underestimated the threat from ISIS?
Well, John, I think that we have to look at ISIS as the leading threat of an international terror network. It cannot be contained. It must be defeated. There is no question in my mind that if we summon our resources, both our leadership resources and all of the tools at our disposal, not just military force, which should be used as a last resort, but our diplomacy, our development aid, law enforcement, sharing of intelligence in a much more open and cooperative way, that we can bring people together. But it cannot be an American fight. And I think what the president has consistently said, which I agree with, is that we will support those who take the fight to ISIS. That is why we have troops in Iraq that are helping to train and build back up the Iraqi military, why we have special operators in Syria working with the Kurds and Arabs, so that we can be supportive. But this cannot be an American fight, although American leadership is essential. So, yes, this has developed. I think that there are many other reasons why it has, in addition to what happened in the region, but I don't think that the United States has the bulk of the responsibility. I really put that on Assad and on the Iraqis and on the region itself.
I would argue that the disastrous invasion of Iraq, something that I strongly opposed, has unraveled the region completely and led to the rise of Al-Qaeda and to ISIS.
Let's just be clear about what you're saying. You're saying Secretary Clinton, who was then Senator Clinton, voted for the Iraq war. And are you making a direct link between her vote for that war and what's happening now for ISIS? Just so everybody
well,
can be clear at home.
I don't think any sensible person would disagree that the invasion of Iraq led to the massive level of instability we are seeing right now. I think that was one of the worst foreign policy blunders in the modern history of the United States.
I have said the invasion of Iraq was a mistake, but I think if we're ever going to really tackle the problems posed by jihadi extreme terrorism, we need to understand it and realize that it has antecedents to what happened in Iraq, and we have to continue to be vigilant about it.
If you look at history, John, you will find that regime change, whether it was in the early 50s in Iran, whether it was toppling Salvador Allende in Chile, whether it is overthrowing the government of Guatemala way back when, these invasions, these toppling of governments, regime changes, have unintended consequences. I would say that on this issue, I'm a little bit more conservative than the Secretary.
Of course, each of these cases needs to be looked at individually and analyzed. Part of the problem that we have currently in the Middle East is that Assad has hung on to power with the very strong support of Russia and Iran, and with the proxy of Hezbollah being there basically fighting his battles. So I don't think you can paint with a broad brush. This is an incredibly complicated region of the world. It's become more complicated. And many of the fights that are going on are not ones that the United States has either started or have a role in. The Shia Sunni split, the dictatorships that have suppressed people's aspirations, the increasing globalization without any real safety valve for people to have a better life. We saw that in Egypt. We saw a dictator overthrown. We saw a Muslim Brotherhood president installed, and then we saw him ousted and the army back. So I think we've got to understand the complexity of the world that we are facing, and no place is more so than in the Middle East.
We have to understand that the Muslim nations in the region, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, Jordan, all of these nations, they're going to have to get their hands dirty, their boots on the ground. They are going to have to take on ISIS. This is a war for the soul of Islam. But those Muslim countries are going to have to lead the effort. They are not doing it now.
I think that is very unfair to a few that you mentioned, most particularly Jordan, which has put a lot on the line for the United States, has also taken in hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria, and has been therefore subjected to threats and attacks by extremists themselves. I do agree that in particular Turkey and the Gulf nations have got to make up their minds. Are they going to stand with us against this kind of jihadi radicalism or not?
I was in Burlington, Iowa, and a mom of a service member of ours who served two duties in Iraq said, "Governor O'Malley, please, when you're with your other candidates and colleagues on stage, please don't use the term boots on Iraq, on the ground. Please don't use the term boots on the ground. My son is not a pair of boots on the ground." These are American soldiers. And we fail them when we fail to take into account what happens the day after a dictator falls, and when we fail to act with a whole-of-government approach, with sustainable development, diplomacy, and our economic power in alignment with our principles.
We invested quite a bit in development aid. Some of the bravest people that I had the privilege of working with as Secretary of State were our development professionals who went, sometimes alone, sometimes with our military, into very dangerous places in Iraq, in Afghanistan, elsewhere. So there does need to be a whole-of-government approach. But just because we're involved and we have a strategy doesn't mean we're going to be able to dictate the outcome. These are often very long-term kinds of investments that have to be made.
Absolutely.
When you talk about the long-term consequences.
All right. Enough of that. But you've had enough to listen to what is being said. Three people up there, the only Democratic candidates so far. By the way, they all agreed to lock out a Democratic candidate. They all agreed that that should be the case. There should not be any other candidate except all three. That's how Democratic they are. So candidate Lessig is not there. So I thought it was very interesting. But what did you hear? Let's talk about what was said among all three of them. What was instructive about that exchange? 888-874-4888 is the number to call. I would love to hear what you just heard. They didn't have to hide it or anything like that. Based on the conversation we just had with Gilbert Messier, the discussions we've been having on this program about U.S. foreign policy and its relationship to a number of developments around the world, including that of terrorism, Islamic terrorism, end quote. What did you just hear? What did you hear from the Democratic Socialist, Bernie Sanders? What did you hear from the former Secretary of State, Hillary Rodham Clinton? What did you hear from Governor Martin O'Malley? The three people vying for the Democratic nomination about this question. And this was after these attacks occurred in Paris. So it was in the aftermath of that, and in conjunction with a number of developments both within the United States and outside of the United States on the question of ISIS, the question of Iraq, the question of Syria. What did you just hear from all of the candidates? What was the agreed upon point? They sounded like they were offering different points of view, of course. But were they? Did you hear something quite disturbing? I heard it. I'm wondering if you did. 888-874-4888. You see, this is how you gauge. Never mind what people are saying. You have to listen. And when you listen, you're getting, in effect, the official stance, not just of the candidates themselves, but in a way they're talking about their official stance as Democrats. As Democrats. What is that official stance? What did it reflect as their understanding of U.S. foreign policy, U.S. involvement, and the U.S. approach to this global issue? I await your calls at 888-874-4888. I like to ask these questions because it forces us to think and to listen for the various levels of meaning. When people speak, and they are speaking now as presidential hopefuls. These are the people who are hoping to be elected to represent this country and represent the people, the American people. What is their understanding of this question about the role of U.S. foreign policy in the immediate situation that they're talking about now, these attacks? What is it that they're saying that their policy will be once they get in to office, assuming that people are naive enough to elect any of them? Do you find that they are telling the real story about U.S. foreign policy? Are they cognizant of it? Well, I will venture to give you one little hint. Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist, had an opportunity to confront Hillary Clinton about her particular involvement in U.S. foreign policy at a time that contributed to one of the worst, he said, was one of the worst decisions, and that was the invasion of Iraq, he said. And the invasion of Iraq, he was able to tie to the emergence of Al-Qaeda and the consequent emergence of ISIS. The moderator asks, are you saying that Hillary Clinton's role as Secretary of State had something to do with that? And he backs away. He's saying any intelligent person essentially visiting this period will be reasonable in concluding that the invasion of Iraq was a mistake. And there she goes. She jumps in and she says, I have said it was a mistake. I've said it was a mistake. Now, I want to just translate that a little bit. There was an opportunity there to set the record straight and set the record right and to hold her publicly accountable as Secretary of State for continuing this outrageous and illegal and immoral war in Iraq. She had already said that she was committed. Even with respect to Iran, she was committed, and still is, I imagine, to, if it even comes down to nuclear war, she would not hesitate to nuke Iran. But here is an opportunity to have the record straight. What was your position? And he was able to just let it slide with the, well, it was a mistake. You call that a mistake? And you are standing before people whose sons and daughters have died by the thousands and who have caused the deaths of thousands and thousands more. And you can just chalk it up. It was a mistake. I made a mistake. No. This is a war crime. He's standing next to a war criminal and does not and dare not say anything about it. So, in other words, when people talk, you would say to yourself, well, let's see if he passes the test, the smell test. And the smell test certainly is one of truth. You should be able to call her out on it right there. Same for O'Malley. You should be able to call out your fellow Democrat who was in a position to do something about it and who, in fact, went along with the program and championed it. But for the sake of politics, we get a backing off. From Vermont, Bill, what have you to say?
Hi there. First of all, this is the first time calling, and I'm a great
Thank
fan
you.
Of your work.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The one thing that I heard during the debate, and I watched it, is that Bernie seemed to be the only one among the three to make a connection between the instability in the world and climate change, which I thought was very interesting.
Yes, but this is nothing new. We were talking,
yeah.
What did you think about his position with respect to ISIS and respect to Hillary Clinton standing right next to him, saying some things that anybody with even the remotest idea of history would have jumped on to correct the record and to hold her publicly accountable?
Well, absolutely. And I think he's a little reserved in that area. I don't think he would want to run a negative campaign. I think that's what his MO has been all along. And so I think there are some missed opportunities there. But at the same time, Bernie just has a way of communicating that he doesn't like to be particularly adversarial to the people who are on the stage with him, because I don't believe he wants to alienate too many Hillary supporters by going after her too strongly.
Well, it's not so much you're going after Hillary Clinton. You're going after her record. She's standing right next to you. If, in fact, you believe that during her tenure, things tantamount to acts of war crimes occurred, would you not step forward and press the point to have her accountable, especially when the moderator jumps in and says, are you saying that Hillary Clinton's vote for the Iraq war was in fact a factor here in the creation of ISIS and the creation of Al-Qaeda, and you say nothing like that? Isn't that
yeah,
a little bit puzzling?
It is puzzling. Well, it's something that I would do if I was on the stage with Bernie, but then again, I'm also not running for president. So I know that there's a fine line you have to walk when he's running for an office with other establishment Democrats on the stage there. And again, if he goes too far out to the left, and these are things I think he honestly believes in, being from Vermont and knowing his record and knowing who he is, what kind of a person he is, I know he believes most of what you're saying here about the connection between and Hillary and the war crimes and all that stuff. I'm fairly certain he honestly believes it, but whether or not he can actually stand up there and say that is an entirely different situation.
Thanks. Thank you, Bill, for calling, and welcome. Thanks for calling
Thank
in.
You.
Well, that brings us to the end of the program. I just wanted to at least get this discussion going in this direction of, here you have three people on the stage. We're real clear that at least one of them, actually all three, but at least one was very much directly involved in formulating and enacting U.S. foreign policy that was dreadful all throughout her tenure. It was consistently dreadful, wrong-headed, and even amounting to war crimes. She's standing right there on the stage, not running away at all. And nobody held her accountable for that. And yet they would tell you, well, you know, we're here fighting to represent you. Thousands of American parents and fathers and sisters are without their loved ones today because of the actions and policies enacted by one of them. And we're real clear as to who it is. Thanks for listening. Coming up next, the Global Research News Hour. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company today. Bye-bye.